working for voter education and registration in the 1960s. I traveled throughout the state of Florida doing that. And I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And SNCC was that bridge between the anti-racist movement for integration and the Black Power anti-colonial movement. And SNCC introduced the whole issue of Black Power to the world. And I was a member of SNCC. And SNCC came under vicious assault partially because of the Black Power demand. People were jailed, were arrested, came under attack, and what have you. You may remember at the time Stokely Carmichael, as he was known, married Miriam McCabe, who was an extraordinary, internationally known artist.
Marion McCabe, the great South African singer. That's Amale Yeshitela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and leader of the Uhuru movement. He's 83 years old. He's due to be sentenced on Monday after a Florida jury found him and his co-defendants, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, known as the Uhuru Three, guilty of conspiring to act as Russian agents, but cleared them of actually doing so. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381, or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
Hey, everybody. Tune in Saturday, December 21st at 5 o'clock for Blues Junction. We're spreading some holiday cheer with singer-songwriter Mark Lemhouse. He's a blues man, and he's got some new music coming out here. I've invited him to come out and do a live performance and interview, and who knows, maybe he'll squeeze in a holiday tune. So again, that's Mark Lemhouse, Saturday, December 21st. You're invited. Winter's now fading, and I won't have to stay here too.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers approve a multi-million dollar package to pay for wildfire bills in this week's special session.
A Vietnamese restaurant sues the city of Portland for racial targeting.
And Vancouver opens winter shelters through March.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 13th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. In a special session Thursday, the legislature approved $218 million to cover the costs of the most expensive Oregon wildfire season to date. In October, the Oregon Department of Forestry asked the state treasury for a $60 million loan to reimburse some of the $130 million the agency spent this past summer. The treasury could have used the Oregon Short-Term Fund to lend the money, but denied the request. Treasury officials worried about ODF's reliance on future funding from the legislature. They also stated that the current Oregon lawmakers could not make decisions that newly elected officials had to stick to when they take office in January. Forestry spokesperson Joy Krawczyk responded by going to the lawmakers directly. She said, quote, we'll be requesting an additional $83 million from the emergency board during December legislative days, end quote. Governor Tina Kotek then announced she would call a special session during the December legislative session in order for lawmakers to send the funds to ODF. In her recently announced budget proposal, she said she wants to funnel money from the state's Rainy Day Fund to ODF and the Office of State Fire Marshal. Both chambers nearly unanimously voted to approve the bill, but lawmakers disagreed on why the department financially struggled. Republicans suggested ODF didn't inform lawmakers about the extent of its mounting costs. They also blamed policies that protect state forests from logging, saying that the lack of logging contributes to expensive fire seasons. Democrats suggested the legislature needs to prepare for fire costs that will continue to climb as the climate crisis worsens. While the federal government will ultimately pay around 60% of the bill, the fire budget will be a top focus for the Oregon legislative session that starts in January.
In August of 2023, the city of Portland opened what it calls a safe rest village for people living in vehicles in the Sunderland neighborhood in northeast Portland. The site had been completed the previous February, but the opening was delayed for 6 months as the city finalized the plan to operate it, along with the Salvation Army, which was contracted to staff and operate the site. The plan was for the village to remain open for 5 years until 2028. But now, the city is announcing that the site will be closing by the end of March next year, 19 months after it opened. The land that the Safe Rest Village occupies used to be used by the Portland Bureau of Transportation, or PBOT, for maintaining its vehicle fleet, but PBOT moved its operations to a new site owned by the Port of Portland. According to the city's website, this move was done under a so-called time-bound permit, and it is unclear if the permit expired or was terminated early. KABU reached out to PBOT for more information without a response by airtime, and this story will be updated next week with any new information. Whatever the case, the Salvation Army plans to stop accepting new guests at the site by the end of December, and the City-County Joint Office of Homeless Services has said it hopes to make sure none of the current guests wind up back out on the streets. In the words of one resident who spoke to KGW, quote, "They're hoping they can help, but right now, they got no promises."
The owner of Pho Gabo, a Vietnamese restaurant in Portland, filed a $2.4 million lawsuit against the city on Wednesday. The lawsuit said, quote, "Plaintiffs were treated differently because of their race and/or national origin and because their business activities reflected such characteristics," end quote. Eddie Dong closed the restaurant in February, which had been in business since 2018. He said a neighbor complained multiple times about the smell coming from the business, which led to mounting fines from the city. The person initially complained in March of 2022, saying the restaurant, quote, "repeatedly produced the odors of grilled meat." The anonymous complainant left at least 4 voicemails, an email, and a monthly observation log with the city. In September 2022, a bureau inspector found the restaurant had violated the city's odor code 1991 that prohibits the, quote, "continuous, frequent, or repetitive odors detectable for more than 15 minutes per day," end quote. The inspector wrote notes saying the restaurant emanated smells, quote, "like a wok dish and like a wok meal." The city started issuing fines by November 2023. Throughout the complaints and fines, Dong had the air filtration and exhaust systems professionally cleaned, shortened the time food was cooked, and even moved meat grilling operations to another Pho Gabo location. He said the transportation of the pre-cooked food, quote, "resulted in various costs and a decline in food quality and sales." The city told Dong that fines would continue until he replaced the air filtration system altogether, worth around $40,000, but it would not guarantee the fines would stop. The lawsuit said, quote, "on information and belief, no restaurant besides Pho Gabo has been required to incur the significant financial burden of entirely new air filtration systems, irrespective of odor complaints issued against them," end quote. Dong closed the Portland restaurant in February, but received another fine in March. By April, he filed a tort claim, or intent to sue the city. In November, Portland City Council voted to update the city's odor code to exempt businesses like restaurants, coffee shops, and nail salons from regulations. The lawsuit claimed, quote, "if taken literally, virtually any restaurant that cooked food on location would be in violation of the odor code," end quote. Dong remains on the lease until this coming January. He owns two other Pho Gabo restaurants, one in Hillsborough and the other in Happy Valley.
With the holiday season in full swing, Christmas tree lots are bustling as families choose the perfect tree to brighten their living rooms. Yet, few pause to consider the labor and sacrifices behind those trees. Labor advocates are shedding light on the conditions faced by the workers who make this cherished tradition possible. Tramell Gomes reports from Virginia.
As families across the country prepare to celebrate the holiday season, the joy of decorating a Christmas tree is a time-honored tradition. But the story behind those trees is often overlooked, revealing a labor-intensive industry supported by immigrant workers who face difficult conditions to bring this holiday centerpiece into our homes. Virginia ranks as one of the nation's top producers of Christmas trees, with thousands of workers tending to the trees year-round. Manuel Gago Silcox with the Workers' Justice Program at the Legal Aid Justice Center says many workers are on H-2A agricultural visas, traveling from Mexico and Central America for seasonal work.
The conditions are in the workplace dangerous. Is a lot of accidents because the tools they use are sometimes like at the area, like on the hills, they're moving like a big tree sometimes, so it's a lot of that.
Compounding these challenges is a systemic issue. Virginia's farm workers are excluded from the state's minimum wage laws. In March, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed a bill that sought to extend minimum wage protections to farm workers, a policy many view as a relic of the Jim Crow era. Youngkin argued that the legislation was unnecessary. Gago Silcox says the dangers for migrant workers don't end in the field. He says many workers are isolated in the hills, disconnected from their families for the months they arrive for temporary work and live in substandard housing.
You need to share the kitchen with 10, 13 people, and sometimes you don't even need to have a real bathroom. You can use a portable toilet outside, and that's okay in the regulations. So the housing conditions are very hard for the workers.
Gago Silcox hopes for future policy changes to ensure that migrant farm workers receive proper protections and fair wages. In the meantime, he encourages consumers to make informed and intentional choices when selecting a Christmas tree. He recommends researching tree farms and choosing smaller operations where you can observe their process and learn how they treat their workers.
Be thankful for the work that the farm workers that came to this country, the sacrifice they have, not only for the family, because at the end, those sacrifices ends in having our Christmas tree in our living room this year.
This is Tramell Gomes for Virginia News Connection.
Biden carries out the largest ever single-day act of clemency. Voting rights advocates raise alarm over Trump's pick to lead Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, and election denier Carrie Lake is tapped to lead Voice of America. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm waiting to see exactly what this list covered before saying what I think the next list should cover, but I'm hopeful that there will be a next list, and I'm glad that the president did this.
Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal credits President Joe Biden for commuting the sentences of 1,500 people on home confinement. Jayapal is also asking Biden to change the sentences of those on federal death row to life in prison before President Donald Trump takes office. The White House is reportedly looking at preemptive pardons for members of the House January 6th committee, who Trump says should be jailed. The former chair, Democrat Benny Thompson of Mississippi, says pardons would be well justified.
We stand by the work of the committee. Our committee did a wonderful job. We shared it with the public, and all the public has to do is to read the report.
Trump is again saying he'll immediately pardon those convicted for January 6th. That came in an interview with Time magazine, which named him its Person of the Year. Meanwhile, a new Justice Department report finds the FBI didn't use undercover informants to investigate the insurrection. It says only three agents were at the Capitol that day, despite persistent rumors that they instigated the violence. Voting rights advocates are raising alarm over Trump's pick to lead the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Attorney Harmeet Dhillon says the 2020 election was stolen and has repeatedly sued to roll back voting rights. She wants more partisan poll watchers and limits to mail-in voting.
Our governments, because of the way that we do elections, are sending ballots to people who aren't entitled to vote. They're registering people who aren't entitled to vote.
Vote fraud almost never happens, but if confirmed, Dylan would oversee hundreds of civil rights attorneys handling anti-discrimination and voting rights cases. Failed Arizona governor and Senate candidate Carrie Lake has been tapped to direct the publicly funded Voice of America, whose coverage Trump criticized as unfair. The former news anchor is a Trump loyalist and election denier who often voices disdain for mainstream media.
You guys up there in the fake news have worn out your welcome. You have spent the last 8 years lying about President Donald Trump and his amazing patriotic supporters.
Echoing an argument made in Congress, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders is asking the federal government to ban those receiving SNAP benefits from spending them on junk food. The state's Secretary of Human Services, Christy Putnam, says nearly a quarter of all SNAP purchases are unhealthy.
If we have better health to start with, then we're going to avoid, you know, the worst health outcomes down the road, like diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease.
Hunger activists say arguments about poor families' food choices could lay the groundwork for slashing safety net programs to offset tax cuts for the wealthy. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 44 degrees, and tomorrow it will be, you guessed it, rainy with a high of 48 degrees. Today in history, Manon Rayom played in a regular season professional hockey game in 1992 and became the first woman to ever do so. The Atlanta Knights coach Gene Ubriaco said, quote, "We gave her a cigar with a note afterwards. Now you're really one of the guys," end quote. The quote of the day was chosen to keep the superstition at bay on this Friday the 13th. Babe Ruth once said, quote, "I had only one superstition. I made sure to touch all the bases when I hit a home run."
A proposed copper mine in the Upper Peninsula is one step closer to getting $50 million in state funds. An educational game teaching children indigenous languages is gaining traction, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a huge investment to support local food systems. With more on those stories, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A proposed copper mine in the Upper Peninsula is one step closer to receiving $50 million in state funds. IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross has the latest.
Funding for the project by the Canadian company Highland Copper was in front of the State House Appropriations Committee on Wednesday. Nicole Kiway-Biber is a citizen of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians and spoke at the hearing.
This is a dangerous project to these places. We can't ignore that. There's a lot of work to be done of restoration. We can invest in repair and cleanup. So vote no on this $50 million.
There's a lot of controversy around the mine and over 300,000 signatures on a petition opposing it. The underground mine would be built near Lake Superior and the Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park in the Upper Peninsula. Supporters, meanwhile, say it could boost flagging local economies and help meet demand for minerals necessary to build renewable energy technologies like windmills. The House committee ultimately advanced the funding. It still needs approval from a state Senate committee. I'm Izzy Ross.
A Suksun language game is quickly gaining recognition since its release in 2023. KBBI's Jamie Deep has more on the game's development that teaches children around the world about Suksun culture.
Developing educational technology skyrocketed during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's when native nonprofit Chugachmut, known in part for its education and health services to tribes on the Kenai Peninsula, began developing an app that teaches Suksun language and school readiness skills for preschool-age children. The app, named Nunaka, the Suksun word for my village, came out last year and has been recognized for its advancements in educational technology. Chugach-Mute Deputy Director Phyllis Wimberly says she came up with this idea more than a decade ago.
I've been thinking about this game since 2012, and it was a matter of getting the funding.
She says she wanted a game that taught the language and skills to prepare children for school, like counting and fine motor skills. The funding ended up coming from the federal government, and Chugach-Mute began developing the game in 2021. The game takes place in a fictional Sukpyak village. Players control a customizable character and play mini-games to complete tasks for their grandparents. They create regalia, go fishing, and pick berries, all while learning Sukstun words. Wimberly says game developers visited Namwalik and Port Graham, two Sukpyak villages at the mouth of Kachemak Bay.
They met with our children. They met with the elders. They recorded elders speaking. It was really a wonderful experience for our game developers and for our elders and children as well.
Children from the villages even got to test the game before its release. Wimberly says it was a hit.
The children would just open their mouths. They were so thrilled with it, and they enjoyed playing it.
Wimberly says she hopes to keep ramping up the nonprofit's education department with plans for a language symposium in February. In Homer, I'm Jamie Deep.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced a $1.3 billion investment to support local and regional food systems. According to the agency, it builds upon the department's previous investments in the Local Food Purchase Assistance Cooperative Agreement and Local Food for School programs. This round of funding was announced in October and will allow states, territories, and federally recognized tribes to purchase wholesome, locally produced foods for distribution within their communities to emergency food providers, school, and child care centers. I'm Jill Freitas.
Workplace exposure to toxic chemicals in dry cleaning cause higher cancer rates among people working in the industry. The Environmental Protection Agency this week banned trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene, known to affect the liver, brain, kidney, and immune and nervous systems. Experts say the ban will better protect workers and consumers' health. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story.
The EPA this week banned a toxic chemical commonly used in dry cleaning and other consumer products. Trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene have been used for decades and are known to affect the liver, brain, kidney, and immune and nervous systems. Research shows dry cleaning and laundry workers are at increased risk from dying of cancer. Jennifer Orm-Zavaleta is a scientist, formerly with the EPA Office of Research and Development. She says businesses will be required to use alternatives and employees will be safer at work, adding that the changes also impact surrounding communities.
So if you happen to live near a dry cleaning facility, you know, there would be the potential for the ground to be contaminated and for these chemicals to get into the water supply.
California has been ahead of the curve. In 2007, the state banned installations of new perchloroethylene dry cleaning machines, required existing ones be shut down by 2010, and required a complete ban of use of the chemical by 2023. Orm-Zavaleta points out many environmental statutes are aimed at cleaning up hazardous chemicals. While recent legislation has enabled the EPA to more effectively reduce exposures or prevent them from happening in the first place, she notes the effort takes time and resources.
The agency has been playing a lot of catch-up. They need to keep going, but they also need to be looking to the future, especially looking at some of the new chemicals coming into commerce.
According to the advocacy group Heal the Planet, the dry cleaning industry uses hundreds of millions of gallons of solvents, such as perchloroethylene, every year. The chemical's airborne particles are difficult to detect in the air and can linger for weeks. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
Jobs like construction come with a higher safety risk, but the protection gear isn't always accommodating to some workers when it comes to fitting them properly. A new federal rule will soon take effect requiring employers in this sector to provide gear that fits everyone on the job site. Mike Moen has more in North Dakota.
With winter underway, outdoor construction workers in North Dakota are likely wearing safety vests over their heavy coats. A new federal rule was announced to ensure that gear fits all crew members, helping maintain diversity in this sector. This week, a new OSHA rule was finalized with language requiring employers to provide personal protective equipment, like hard hats, that properly fits each construction worker on a given site. It's aimed at accommodating underrepresented populations in this field, including women. Jason Ellert of North Dakota's Building Trades Unions calls this a common sense approach to letting women know their workplace needs are prioritized.
We want them to experience these great career paths, but if the equipment doesn't fit them right, are we putting our money where our mouth is?
According to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, 41% of women say their protective equipment fits them poorly. Supporters say the change could also benefit workers with disabilities or those with larger or much smaller body types. Federal officials predict this move won't be an issue for employers worried about added costs in making these investments. Ellert says this coincides with efforts in North Dakota to diversify the construction trades. That includes an apprenticeship program geared for Native Americans. Regardless of race, gender, or body type, he says properly protecting all workers helps ensure they won't have to abandon their career due to an injury.
If we didn't get the helmets fitting correctly, you know, that could lead to other issues down the road, CTE, concussions, those kinds of things.
Federal officials note properly fitting gear allows workers to carry out their tasks more confidently. The rule change is scheduled to go into effect mid-January. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
As an as yet unknown disease has killed dozens of people in a remote area of the Democratic Republic of the Congo's southwestern Kwango province. The illness, which doctors in the area describe as flu-like, has killed somewhere between 31 and over 140 people since October. The low estimate comes from the World Health Organization and only takes account of deaths in hospitals. Since it was first noticed in October, the disease has sickened over 500 people. The symptoms include severe headache, cough, high fever, nausea, and anemia, and the majority of cases, as well as deaths, have been children under 14 years old. Local and international medical teams are working in the area to determine the cause of the illness and why it so disproportionately affects children. However, the work is hampered by the region's remoteness and largely rural character, with minimal infrastructure. On Tuesday, the WHO announced that a majority of blood samples from affected people had tested positive for malaria, leading to speculation that the cause could be a combination of malaria with either severe malnutrition or other diseases or both. The outbreak comes just months after the WHO announced a severe epidemic of mpox in Congo and other areas of Africa, which is ongoing.
As climate change makes wildfires larger and more intense, they're putting more carbon pollution into the atmosphere. It creates a vicious cycle. Wildfires make climate change worse and vice versa. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Intense wildfires can endanger lives, destroy homes, cause hazardous air quality hundreds of miles away, and contribute to global warming. When trees and plants burn, they emit carbon dioxide and other climate warming gases.
Those emissions can have quite a large impact on the climate.
That's Douglas Kelly, a fire scientist at the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. He says last year, massive wildfires in Canada raged across huge areas of forest. In a recent study, Kelly and his team found that because of their size and intensity, those fires produced about 9 times more carbon pollution than Canadian wildfires produce in an average year. After a fire, some carbon gets reabsorbed as trees and plants regrow. But when fires are so massive, much more is released than can be reabsorbed. So as the climate warms, there's potential for a vicious cycle. Climate change makes intense fires more likely by bringing hotter, drier conditions. Those extreme fires, in turn, become a growing source of carbon pollution.
It might actually drive more climate change in the future, which might mean we see more of these fires as well.
Putting forests and people at risk. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to Pearl Stark for The Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser produced at KPOV Bend. This week's puzzle involves the difference between love and hate.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, we started with two varieties of pie. Rearrange the letters, and you have three well-known companies of 4 letters each. Two of the companies are real, and one is best known in a fictional setting. Well, the answer is key lime and pecan, which becomes Acme, Nike, and Yelp. Our winner this week is Jill Ortley, who listens to KYAQ in Waldport, Oregon.
I'm too full for broccoli, but I still have room for some pie. And I know that it's strange and it's hard to explain, although I'll give it a try.
For the new puzzle, start with a word for something that you hate. Remove two A's and you will have a word for something that expresses praise. So again, start with a word for something that you hate. Remove two of the letter A and you will have a word for something that expresses praise. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of December 9th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, Eliza Yurkov, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Jill Freitas, Mike Moen, Tramel Gomes, Nadia Romligon, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast